But no, I never thought about winning. Beating Susie the first year was probably was what I wanted to do.
Okay. So it wasn't that you needed to, you didn't necessarily need to win, but you had to beat Susie. I get that. We've all got it. We've all got our Susies. We all have our Susies that we want to finish.
I got too many miles to go. I'm just an old hard rocker running from the dust till dawn. Yeah, I'm just a midnight walker. Wonder what's it taking so long. When the sun goes down, that's when I'll sing my
song. So, hey, everybody. My name is Dan Ryan. I am the social media director for the Hard Rock 100 Endurance Run. Today, I'm joined by my co-host, Chris Twiggs, as well as Rick and Nancy Hamilton.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm Chris Twiggs, man without a title, a 16-time Hard Rock finisher, and a man who's very, very interested in collecting all of these amazing Hard Rock stories. And we've got some great ones today. The first female Hard Rocker. She was the first woman to finish Hard Rock.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty badass.
Yeah. So I was just pulling up her. I just looked up Nancy Hamilton on Ultra Running Magazine's website. And she's got a little bit of results. I guess, you know, Ultra Sign Up wasn't around in 1992, or, you know, 1993, four, you know, when the internet wasn't around.
.coms, yes.
Right. So all of these would have been listed in a published magazine, which is pretty neat.
This is the way it was back then. I can remember when I was registering for Hard Rock back then, I'm pretty sure I had to submit like a photocopied page from Ultra Running Magazine that showed my results from back then. I used Leadville as my qualifier, and I had to submit a photocopied page of that magazine to show my results.
So I'm noticing a clear trend here.
Yes.
In 1988, her first ultra marathon, just like David Horton, was JFK 50 in Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
She ran 9 hours and 20 minutes. Fifth in her gender and 70th overall. So, I mean, looking at these results, it shows that there really has been an explosion recently of trail and ultra runs all over the country, because you've got JFK, you've got Mount Masochist, you've got Strolling Jim, you've got Leadville, you got Hard Rock and Wasatch, right? Those are just, I just named off, what, seven classics?
Yeah.
And Horton has done, I think, the similar slew in the early 90s. So it just kind of shows, like, go look at anybody's ultra sign up page now, and it's just, you know, oh, I've never heard of that race.
Oh, you know, you're exactly right. I mean, there was a time when you probably could have done all of the hundreds that existed in the country in a year, maybe even, or in a couple of years. And I know not that long ago, you know, I'm down here in Florida, not that long ago, I had a friend who did all of the hundreds in Florida. And now I can't count the hundreds that are down here. And again, they're ones that you never would have heard of.
What are we going to talk to Nancy about today?
Well, I mean, obviously we want to talk to her about what it was like back in the early days, get her take similar to what we got from David Horton. I'm also really interested in, you know, we heard from David that he and Dennis Herr had started together and they had tried to run together. And then, you know, he said, you know, Dennis needed to lie down and take a nap. I've heard it from others that actually Dennis was tired of hearing David talk and just needed a break from David. That's what Dennis told Dale Garland. So, but what did happen, as you can see from the results in that first year, is that Rick and Nancy Hamilton finished together. So they accomplished what David did not, which was to run together as a pair throughout. And that's something I've never done. And it's something I've heard of people trying, but it's gotta be hard to do, right? Because if you are running 100 miles with another person the whole time, you are always moving at the pace of the person who's having the worst day, right? If someone's struggling at night, you're going as slow as that person is struggling. And then the next day, if that person maybe is recovering and feels great, but the other one doesn't feel so good, well, you got to keep going slow. So that's an interesting thing to be held back. Of course, they're married, so that either helped or hurt. I don't know which. So I'm interested in hearing about that experience of being with somebody that whole time, and especially that first year. And then obviously the big thing, and one of the reasons why people would have heard of Rick and Nancy Hamilton, other than just looking at the results from the run from years past, is there a trivia question that was often asked in the gym in Silverton, which was to name the first married couple to have both finished Hard Rock. And a lot of people came up with a lot of different answers of other couples that we've seen out there. And there's some great power couples of Hard Rock history, but the Hamiltons were the first, right? And was she waiting on him, trying to get him to pick it up, or was he pushing her? I don't know. I really don't. Did you look up his results?
No, Rick Hamilton, I have not looked up his results. Let me pull them up.
I honestly don't know which one was faster.
So the Rick Hamilton that's on here, his first ultra was also JFK. Mm-hmm. He ran it in 8:48.
So that is faster than Nancy's time was.
Right. And he was gender place 40, overall place 42. Mm-hmm. And he also ran Strolling Jim. So it looks like they ran all their races together. Maybe this result list is a little incomplete as well, but it looks like Hard Rock 100, 7:11:92, result 45:47, overall place 11, gender place 11. This is going to be interesting, I think.
I'm very much looking forward to it. They no longer live in Ouray, but they have a house, had a house in Ouray. They built a house in Ouray, which shows you the impact that Hard Rock can have on people. They, to come out and learn about the San Juans and first be in the San Juans for Hard Rock and then end up wanting to live there. And their house was on the same hill as my in-law's house. So I would walk up the hill from from the post office or grocery store, I'm walking up to my in-law's house and I'm looking at the Hamilton's house just up the hill from it. And I would bump into them in town every summer and missed seeing them there this summer. I hope they manage to come back out maybe next summer. Obviously, we want all Hard Rockers to find their way to Silverton in the summer. It's where we belong. And they were there at the beginning, and it'd be neat to have them there again, but they're not living there any longer, but it'll be interesting to hear that part of their story as well. Rick and Nancy Hamilton are here with us. Nancy is the first female Hard Rocker, the first woman to finish the Hard Rock 100. We heard in our first episode from David Horton, who was the first man to finish, and we're delighted to be joined by Rick and Nancy here, who both finished. Not only was Nancy the first woman to finish Hard Rock, but Rick was right there by her side, pretty much step by step. So we're very interested in hearing that story from the two of you. So Rick and Nancy, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
We'd love to start off by asking, first of all, because you guys were there from the very, very beginning, how did you first find out about the Hard Rock?
I don't know. We did Leadville and loved running in the high mountains. And I don't know. I guess.
Hard Rock was being advertised at that point as a real postgraduate trail run. And they were very particular, the organizers were very particular about the folks that they let in. They wanted people that weren't going to kill themselves, that had some familiarity with the mountains, and had the ability to do the run. And Nan had done Barkley and Leadville and various stuff, and I'd done other hundreds and stuff, and this seemed like fun. Something that we, sounded like fun. So that's how we got involved.
Did you have anything to add there, Nancy?
No, that sounds pretty cool. Much the way it worked. She was Susie Tebow then, and she and I thought we could have fun together. And I don't know. We just thought it sounded like something fun and a great adventure.
Nancy Tebow. I'm looking on the finishers list from 1992.
Susie Tebow.
Man, I am rough with names this morning. Mm-hmm. Susie Tebow.
Think she finished, Chris.
Okay.
She didn't finish the first year.
She didn't make it past Cunningham, I don't think.
No, mm-hmm.
And it was clockwise.
There she is. Yep. It looks like she dropped to Cunningham.
It's rough getting that close.
Yeah, it's very rough getting that close at mile 90.1.
Well, it wasn't exactly easy from 90.1
to the finish.
It still isn't.
I mean, it may have only been 9 miles, but that's
Divey's little giant had to be shoveled. We shoveled switchbacks into Divey's little giant on the Cunningham side to get up over the damn mountain.
That sounds like this year, Chris.
So you guys had to do your own trail work before you did the run.
Well, of course.
Wow.
Aren't you supposed to?
Do you want a story?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Okay. Here, Horton, David Horton and Nancy and I had done other races, and we decided to do Hard Rock, the three of us. We drove out together. I think David probably told you that. Mm-hmm. And we ended up doing Pikes Peak from Manitou Springs one morning. This was in June. And waded through the snow at the top of Pikes Peak to get to the top. It was brutal.
Yeah.
And then drove to Ouray from Manitou Springs. And basically, Nan wandered out the next morning and said, "This is where I want to spend the rest of my life."
You're right.
And subsequently,
30 years later.
Yeah, we more or less did. But so we're riding around out in the middle of nowhere outside Silverton with Horton, and we see these guys standing at the pullover overlook outside Silverton that looks up at Divey's Little Giant. Mm-hmm. That's where the tram line runs up. And Horton said, wait, that's Rick Trujillo. So we get out, and it's John Kappas and Gordon Hardman and Charlie Thorne and Rick Trujillo standing there. So we ended up meeting them that way and making friends with them. And at that point, they were trying to decide where the course was going to be. You understand that there was no course. They were trying to decide where the course was and whether or not that could be used. So it was that much of an infant at that point. John had worked it all out on paper. But, you know, paper's kind of flat. And it's just not the same. And so we fell in with them, and after that, everything they did, we did. Mm-hmm. And the short version of this is that everybody that was involved in the first year, we didn't know where we were going or what we were doing. And we were kind of doing these sections trying to figure out whether they would go.
And then how you link each section to finish within 48 hours.
Yeah, because when we were out wandering around, there was no way you could get all those sections together less than 48 hours.
Well, we thought.
Because it took us so darn long, each section. Because where there were no markings, there was hardly any trail in most of the places. So that was our introduction.
How long before, how much time before Hard Rock started were they still trying to figure out where it was going to go?
This was 2 to 3 weeks.
Oh my gosh.
Well, then it was 2 to 3 weeks. And then they got one of those Trails Illustrated maps and drew a line on it. And that was the course.
And Rick Trujillo wheeled it.
Was it that year?
Yeah, it was the first year.
He took a wheel out there and measured it?
Yeah, he had it. He made a wheel, and a measuring wheel, and it was a bike tire. And he would run along with the bike tire measuring the court. So it was kind of close. I mean,
that's crazy.
Well, the other thing, too, guys, it was kind of funny, is that there were no markers to speak of. You had to pretty much know where you were going.
Yeah, the elk ate the markers.
The elk and the marmots ate the markers.
Because they were soy based.
They used little surveyor's pins. And the little surveyor's pins got trampled and eaten. So you'd be out in the middle of nowhere in the middle of the night, and you'd find a pin trampled into the ground with a little teeny bit of orange at the top, where the marmots couldn't eat it because of the metal. And you knew you were kind of on course.
Well, a very quick, funny story. Essie Garrett, who is no longer living, but Essie was one of the girls that ran the first year. And Essie lost her shoe. Where was that?
It was in, after the Silverton Aid Station.
Well, anyway, it was boggy. She lost her shoe, and she said to God, "If you help me find my shoe, I swear I'll never come back again." She found her shoe.
Yeah.
Did she ever come back?
I think that was the only year she did it.
Wow.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that was the only year she did it. And we hadn't talked to her for such a very long time and found out that she had actually had kind of a sad life and ended up homeless and had died. But she was funny. Oh, my gosh. But she did find her shoe. So it had a good.
I diverged, guys.
Anyway. No, that's great. This is why we're doing this. We want to capture these stories. I will say, I have lied to God so many times on the Hard Rock course.
He's really busy that week.
I believe it.
He's very busy that weekend. There's a lot of messages coming from Silverton and the environs.
That moves us into our second one, like talking about bogs and stuff like that. What surprised you the most about the Hard Rock course?
Well, it was different than anything I'd done before, but I didn't like road running. I started out road running, but ended up really loving the mountains. And I don't know, it was just so beautiful, but hard. And, you know, as we said earlier, the sections in training took so long. You couldn't figure out how in the world you were going to be able to link, you know, each training run together to finish the race under 48 hours. And it worked.
To me, the sheer beauty of it was awesome.
Yeah.
And what ended up happening with Hard Rock, unlike Leadville, which we consider a road race, you had to learn all the mountaineering terminology and of how to describe various things.
Plants. Like they kept talking like about willows.
Yeah, they kept talking about willows.
Well, I didn't see willow trees.
There were no
Nobody
willows.
Nobody told me there were any willows.
Yeah, willow trees.
Willows.
Yeah, willows are 40 feet tall, 50 feet tall. And, you know, weeping willows. That's what we thought they were. We didn't know they were these impenetrable forests.
Scrub bushes.
Awful. And, man, when you get lost in the willows, it's bad. Real bad.
But anyway, little things like that, you know, and just, you know, just different terminology for things that were different from the East Coast. The same geographic issues that you're talking about, but different names. And so
it took a while to get used to everything, because it was it wasn't like Leadville was the only other mountain experience we'd had like that. I mean, we'd been in the East, the Old Dominion and Vermont and those. But you got to remember, back in those days, there were very few hundreds. You know, it was only in 84 when Tom Green did the 400s in a year. And that was Old Dominion, Wasatch, Wasatch, Western States. And
Leadville?
Leadville. Yeah, Leadville was the fourth one. And that was only in 84. So by the time of Hard Rock, there were still maybe half a dozen or eight maybe in the whole country.
Yeah, that was the thing.
Rather than one every weekend.
Yeah, when we started doing hundreds or even ultra distance running, the group of people was so much smaller. You know, you didn't have such a diversity of people from all over everywhere. It was the same kind of core group that we run with.
All over the country.
All over the country, but for years. But it was a much smaller group of people. So you really knew everybody and had a lot of experience running with them in different races across the country.
So you'd run with a lot of other folks that ended up coming out, and you mentioned David Horton, that you guys had traveled out there together. That first Hard Rock year, Nancy, you were the female champion of the run. Was that something that you were trying to accomplish going in? Did you think, hey, this is my chance to win a 100-miler, or was it just something that fell into your lap?
I never entered a race as wanting to win. For me, it was just the adventure. And I never ran with a watch, and I never ran with split times. I just ran the way I felt. And other than the first year with Susie T, my nemesis, but a very dear, good friend, because we did Barkley, she and I were the first women to finish Barkley. And so we like to do that kind of stuff. But no, I never, winning was just, you know, icing on the cake, surprise, you know. And, but as time has passed, the times have gotten so much faster. And I was just never very fast. I just didn't like quitting. So, you know, that was, but no, I never thought about winning. Beating Susie the first year was what I wanted to do.
Okay. So it wasn't that you needed to, you didn't necessarily need to win, but you had to beat Susie. I get that. We've all got our Susies. We all have our Susies that we want to finish in front of.
Yep. I have not ran the race personally. But I think Chris has a Susie out there as well.
For sure. Yeah.
Everybody does.
We've all got a Susie.
So you wanted to beat Susie. The next thing I want to, we kind of want to talk about is, besides beating Susie, what do you love the most about the San Juan Mountains? If I'm not mistaken, you guys ended up buying a house there and living there for a really long time in Ouray. Did you move there to be closer to Hard Rock, or, you know, just for your love of the San Juan Mountains?
Obviously, Hard Rock showed us various parts of the San Juan Mountains that you would not normally get to. And we just really learned to love mountaineering and being so close to so many beautiful hidden spaces, places that you could go and not have to deal with people, Susies. And I think that Ouray was an enticement. And we met through Rick Trujillo. We met so many wonderful friends. And so we felt very comfortable there and were able to do it that in that particular time of our life. I had a lot of back issues over the years, And I guess about 10 years ago, I was paralyzed from the chest down. So it kind of ended my being able to play in the high mountains. But, you know, never, you never forget the magical times and the really hard times. And I feel so thankful to God that I was able to have that time there and meet so many wonderful people who became very good friends.
We built two houses in Ouray. And when we were there the very first year, Nan had expressed her desire to
live there and die there,
hopefully at old age. And
out there on the trail.
Yeah.
Exactly.
She tried. She tried to do that too the second year of Hard Rock.
Wasn't very successful.
She failed that. That was one of the few things that she's failed at. but we moved into Trujillo's essentially and bought the lot right across the street from him and built a little house. And for various reasons, we ended up building another house. And so we were there for a long time, you know, 29 years,
more or less. Almost 30 years.
And until it became difficult for us physically, that's when we finally moved. I mean, house number two was four stories. And without an elevator on a slope. So, as you know, Chris, you know the house.
I know the house. It's beautiful, beautiful house. But yeah, it'd be tough to get around if you had any mobility issues.
Yeah.
Well, it was really hard, too, sitting there and looking up at the mountains that I love so much and was incapable of getting there on my own. It was really hard. And so that's when we decided that we would just move back east. And it's great because our family's here, our grandchildren are here. And, you know, sometimes you just have to do what you have to do. And
Daniel, as you asked, why we ended up being in Ouray primarily was love of the mountains. It wasn't Hard Rock per se, it was love of the mountains and being able to do 13ers all over the place within a few minutes, essentially, and having the incredible access to trails without having to get in a car. I mean, you can go all over, you know, everywhere, quite a bit of the Hard Rock course, you know, right from Ouray without even getting in a car. And that is what we really love. I mean, it was just, we cleared out the quads. We did all the 13ers on the quads in the area, and except for two, three, if you include Snowden, south of Silverton. And that was what was fun, wandering around in the middle of nowhere.
I know it must have been hard looking out at that view. And knowing that you're not going to be going back up to some of those peaks. But at the same time, my first time that I went to Ouray, I remember sitting on the porch and looking out essentially the same view that you folks had up on that same hill. And I remember looking around and saying, someday I want to be able to sit on this porch with a cup of coffee and look out and say, I've been there and I've been there. And I've been, and you know, I wanted to be able to say I'd been to all of those. And now I've been going out to Ouray for 25 years. And yeah, I can sit on that porch and I everywhere I point is someplace that I've been. And I love that. I love that, you know,
yeah, it's a place. That's, you know, it was just so much fun knowing that you got yourself to those spots. And our friend Rick Trujillo used to term here, there, and everywhere, HT&Es. And that's what Rick and I learned to really love, is just wandering, not on a trail, but just going across the tundra in the high country and just wandering. you know, not really a destination, but just to wander
here,
and see.
Here, there, and everywhere, HT&E's, that's great. What we were doing. That was the best.
And the ant, you know, is what you see, and, you know, having our dog with us, you know, and the flowers. And it wasn't any destination. It's the journey, was everybody says. And it's true. It was just wandering.
Talking about it makes me miss it even worse.
I know. Well, you need to come out. You need to come back out. So talk about the journey a little bit. That first Hard Rock, the two of you entered.
So I had a little follow-up question there first, Chris.
Is it about the dog?
No, it was going to be. Well, okay, what kind of dog was it?
A standard poodle.
Okay. Great mountain partner, I bet.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we've had four of them.
Wow.
Three of them have been great mountain partners. So,
nice.
Yes.
So the follow-up question I wanted to actually ask that wasn't about the dog. I do love dogs myself. I am a very big dog fan. What was your favorite spot in the San Juan Mountains? If you had to pick one.
Porphyry Basin. Porphyry Basin is on the ridgeline of the Red Mountains. It's the turn just past Imogene Pass turn. And there are two lakes up there. And the whole area is ringed by ridgelines, which are two separate named 13ers. And basically, there are little waterfalls in there and ponds all over the place. And you can walk up there and just wander. And the flowers are, you know, intense in their time period. And there's plenty of water for the dogs. And there's nowhere for the dog to go because of it's like a giant dog playpen.
It's a dog park.
Yeah, it's like a gigantic dog park.
It's a good choice, yeah.
It's gorgeous. And the lakes up there, they're two separate lakes. Bullion King and I can't think of the name of the other lake. But they've blocked off some of the access to that. You used to be able to drive damn near the whole way up to it. And of course, you could a zillion years ago, for sure. But it's a little bit of a hike, but it's absolutely gorgeous. Gorgeous.
It's hard. It's hard for me to say because each place holds a special memory in my heart. So, you know, Porphyry Basin was great because it's close to the house and the dog loved it. And we have actually built a cairn there, and the cairn holds our two other dogs' ashes. And then, so we go up each year and rebuild the cairns after the marmots used to get after them. And I don't know, I can't say. I no matter where we were, you just look and say, I can't believe I'm here. I can't believe I got here. I don't know. I can't pick.
Part of the thing, Daniel, is, for instance, the Imogene Pass Road. I said Imogene Pass. Is that right?
Yeah.
Imogene Pass. There's a pass when you get up to Black Bear Pass. You get up to Black Bear. That's the first place where you can decide whether to turn around or not. And there's a pass between Black Bear Pass and over to Porphyry Basin. And you walk across the tundra, and there's a really cool lake that nobody ever goes to in there. And then you walk up, not very far, it might be 200 or 300 vertical feet, and you get into this little pass that leads over into Porphyry. And one of the joys of wandering around like that, right there at that pass, the ground is exposed, and there are these little incredibly cool iron oxide crystals that are shaped like cubes. And you'll see them all over the place, but right there they seem to be particularly heavy, and they're not very big, maybe an eighth of an inch to a quarter of an inch, cubes, perfectly shiny cubes. And that's the kind of cool stuff when you're doing HT&Es that you end up seeing out there in the San Juans. And it's kind of like, let's go see, you know, whether there are crystals here or whether there are crystals there. You know, you can find amethyst crystals up there in various places. You can find beautiful clear crystals. You can find iron oxide crystals. And if you pay attention.
Yeah, that was our big thing. We go crystal hunting. We had a very dear friend of ours, and he and I would joke because they needed to make instead of Alcoholic Anonymous, they needed to make a crystal finding, stealing anonymous, because I would come back with my pack so heavy, it was all I could do to get it back to the Jeep with crystals. And we still have a bunch back here with us back east that, you know, and that was fun. I love going to Maggie Gulch, going straight up the hill, up on the ridge line, and we'd come across, you know, cougar smells where the cougar had managed to pee, and you'd find, you know, where the cougar had killed an elk, or you could look down and watch an elk herd. You know, it was just such an adventure every single time, and it didn't matter where you were, it was like being in heaven.
Sorry, we digress.
This is great. This is great.
I just put Porphyry Basin on my list for this weekend. So
it's beautiful.
Really neat. It's a beautiful.
Yeah, I just found the whole map to it, and that's why I'm looking this direction. I've got another screen. I'm not ignoring. I'm just looking at pictures, and it looks like there's King Boyan Lake.
Yes.
Boyan King Lake, and then it looks like it's Porphyry Lake.
Porphyry. Oh, stupid me. Yes.
Very obvious.
Exactly.
Yeah. But I mean, me and my dog are going to go up there this weekend.
Well, go up the right-hand side. You can go up through the cliffs on the right-hand side from the parking area.
Okay.
And then make a big loop. It's really right. Cool. And then come back down by... Come back down the drainage right to Bullion King.
Okay.
It's cool. Beautiful. Or you can walk over. You can walk over to, what's the lake beyond that? That cross country hike.
I'm looking at it, but I can't remember.
Well, you can get all over the place. You can get to Telluride from there if you want.
Cool. So, bringing it back to Hard Rock for a second, I would love to know. So that the two of you, first year. From looking at the results that we see on open split timing, it looks like the two of you were together pretty much the whole time. And that's fascinating to me, because my feeling is if I'm going to run 100 miles with somebody, we're always going at the pace of whoever is having the worst time at that moment, right? I'm also intrigued by the concept of doing that with your spouse, because that's got to be a test to a relationship. But I'm also wondering, were you guys ever competitive? Was there any thought of Nancy of just dropping this guy and finishing ahead of him, or vice versa? Rick, did you ever were you trying to race each other or pull each other?
I think so. I never. You know, our running styles were so different. Rick has always been much faster than I was, but I also had endless endurance. And when we were finishing Hard Rock the first year, and I mean, it had been a long day, two days.
It was raining.
Pouring down rain.
Yeah, pouring down rain.
And I swore we were coming into the finish. And of course, it was a little different course then. And I swore that Rick was going the wrong direction. I said, gosh darn it, I've come all this way and you're making me be disqualified because I went off course. And he said, shut up. Come with me.
So there might have been a little bit of testiness there at the end.
Well,
no, I got tired.
Nan was headed up Cement Creek.
I was swore.
And That was definitely not the right direction to take when the rain with the time limit looming. So
he was so funny.
We
shut up.
I usually would go kind of bumble along myself, and usually I'd slow up and Nan would catch up and we'd just kind of hang out together. And my natural pace is good for about 80 miles, definitely not 100 miles. I have to have somebody with me that talks sense to me and keeps me from blowing myself up, which is what I normally do.
Mm-hmm. We've always run together, though. All our running life, Rick has run his entire life, and I learned to run after he and I got married. And so we've always just run together and enjoyed it. You know, it was always a really good time. And as you know, Chris, you run with your son. We would run with our youngest son. And it was just fun, you know, and I don't think we were competitive.
No, there was no sense of competition between us.
No. I mean, I'm competitive, but I just wasn't.
Just against Susie.
Yeah, with Susie. When we, she'll love that. When we were.
God, I hope she doesn't hear this.
Oh, I hope she does.
And I think we've now coined a new term that we're going to be using in this podcast from now on. We'll have to ask our guests, who is your Susie?
To answer the question, no, we were never competitive. We just enjoyed being in the woods together or in the mountains together. And we did Barkley together. And
Barkley, when Susie and Nancy did Barkley, it looked like so much fun. I wanted to do it. So we came back the next year and we did the front run. Nancy and I did the front run together the next year. And it was really fun. I mean, it's really, really fun. And you don't hear that nowadays from the people that finish it. It's kind of like this heroic thing. And they always talk about, you know, being wild and tough, and not to use the Hard Rock terms, but it isn't that at all. It's the fun. Hard Rock was fun. It was crazy fun. And, you know, that's what these races are about. They're fun.
Yeah.
I think we lose track of that a little bit today. Races just being fun or just trying to experience the event. People run for a lot of different reasons, it seems. And I think we lose track of just having fun sometimes. So I'm glad you guys said that.
Amen. I agree.
All right, Dan.
So last time we talked with Jeff Browning, and he gave us some hilarious stories from out on the Hard Rock course. You know, hiding under Lightning Rock that he's now named, or climbing into somebody else's tent because they got caught in a horrible thunderstorm. Just all kinds of stories from across the Hard Rock course. So did David Horton. He gave us a bunch of stories from the course. So the question that the next question we ask is, what is your favorite stories from Hard Rock, or what are some of your favorite stories from Hard Rock? Just talk about your experiences there, or who you met, or what you did.
Well, Essie Garrett, for sure, for me, when she lost her shoe. And I don't know, I hilarious stories. You know, when you're running, you pick up with somebody and you share so much. The one story that was pretty funny is when we first started reading the race directions, they said, running on the
pipeline.
You had to on the pipeline. Well, I thought they meant I had to do it on the pipeline, and so I get myself.
This is coming into your ray.
Yeah, into your ray. So I get myself up on the pipeline, and it was pretty good as long as it was tight up against the side, but then it kind of gets farther and farther away. And so I'm sitting on it.
It goes over the gorge in places. Mm-hmm.
And there is no way I could stand up. So I sat on it and I would itch myself along. And finally I said, I am not doing this. If I have to do this to run Hard Rock, well, forget it. But it was my own silly mistake thinking that I was supposed to be. But Trujillo does it, so I figure, well, he can do it. But that was her.
You were permitted. You could have run on the trail right next to the pipeline, and that would have been acceptable.
Yeah. The original course, if I'm not mistaken, came down from Bear Creek, and you crossed the dam rather than the creek, just above the dam.
Well, you went all the way to the end to where the dam was.
Yeah, you went the whole way down to the dam and crossed the dam and then came down the basically fire road to the left-hand side of the gorge. Well, the west side of the gorge. And I think that was the original course. And I think, I can't remember, it was a couple of years before they changed it to the crossing the creek and going up over that knob and then coming down to the fire road. So there were so many stories. All of this, I've told some of them, and do we have, funny stories? Yeah, if we had all day long to sit and think about it, we probably would come up with some more. The thing was, is that it was just so relaxed. And we literally were, when we were out there in the what they called training runs, they weren't exactly training runs. They were course finding runs.
Yeah, familiarizing yourself with the course.
Well, yeah, but they Charlie and Gordon and John and Rick Trujillo were basically desperately trying to get the course laid out, before the race. And they may end up telling you, that, oh, we knew what we were doing, but the first day we met them, they were trying to figure out whether Divey's Little Giant was a go. And it's like, holy smokes, when we got there, it was 3 weeks before the race. Enough time to reasonably acclimate and get used, figure it out.
Well, the one story with Charlie Thorne and his, what was Charlie's dog's name?
I can't remember.
Anyway, Charlie Thorne had his dog, and his dog would eat anything.
Oh my God, I'd forgotten about that.
Dead anything. So Rick gave the dog a couple Tums to settle the dog's stomach. Well, Charlie about had a heart attack. How can you give my dog Tums? And it's like, the dog is eating dead worms.
really dead worms.
I don't think the Tums are really going to bother him. They might make him feel a little bit better. Athena.
Yeah.
And
being lost, one of the places that was a particularly good place to get lost, and it was hard to figure out where the course needed to go, was Pole Creek. And that trail that's on, I guess it would be the north side maybe of Pole Creek. The trail's north on the north side now. But then the whole bunch of us, that was when we learned about willows. Man, were we ever lost in the willows. And down in Pole Creek, the willows down in Pole Creek are, it's a bog. It isn't just like these are trees growing out of the dirt. There was water up over your ankles. And then you get into the snow higher up. And it was really, really hilarious because it just took us forever. And when they finally figured out that there was decent trail on the north side of Pole Creek, that's where there were these bogs. And that's where, if you stepped in the bog, you went in up to your knee.
That's where S.C. Oster
said. And it was on the trail. It was just like a pit of bog. And that's where S.C. Garrett lost her shoe. And other people lost shoes in there, even during the race. So, oh my gosh,
there are a lot of funny stories that happened at a particular place with a particular runner, and, you know, somewhere during the race. And that was fun because everybody, you know, you get to the point where it's just either cry or laugh. It's better to laugh. And, you know, people going off course and ending up golly knows where and managed to find their way back. You know, it was because there was a course and you're always supposed to stay on course. But the first year, since the marmots ate the flags, you did the best you could. You know, you just, or, and you'd see marmots hanging from the pink soy-based little flag, eating it while it's hanging upside down. Yeah, crazy little stuff. And but
couldn't you just get around the course by looking for the hanging marmots at that point?
Yeah.
the little guys were very determined because it was their time. I mean, they just come out of their burrows.
They're hungry.
And we learned, it may be not true, but that the surveyor's flags on those little pins are soy-based, and they tasted good to the marmots. And the elk, I don't know whether they ate them, they just tramped them. That was challenging.
So you did the best you could to stay on course, but I can't say that every step that we took was literally on course. You know, you had to kind of figure your way. But that, you know, that's when I really learned to love HT&E, because, I mean, it was fun. It was crazy.
Trying to get up handies the first year.
Oh, Chuck Kroger. I asked him to marry me when I got to the top. No, wasn't he? That was at...
Where did Kroger... No, that was at... shoot.
Where did Chuck Kroger have his...
Kroger's canteen.
Yeah.
Virginia's Pass.
Virginia's Pass. So we got up there, and I asked him if he'd marry me, because he handed me a cup of chicken noodle soup, and he said, no, he's already married. I said...
That was okay. The first year?
That wasn't the first year. Okay. Man was with Chuck Kroger. Chuck, I think, did it the first year.
No, okay. he was manning the aid station.
No. There was no aid station to speak of up there the first year.
Well, anyway, I was hallucinating.
There was no aid station up there the first year. No, or maybe there was, but there wasn't much of one. Not like Chuck ended up having.
Anyway.
I think Chuck actually helped Nancy up handies. And there was a snowstorm on Handy's in the first year, and it was really cold and hard and
slippery.
And I can't remember what time of the day it was. It was daylight.
I think it was toward evening.
I don't remember.
I don't know. I found a knit hat that somebody had lost, which I coveted. I put it on my head and there it stayed. I don't know who it belonged
to. We all huddled up there on the top of Handy's. That was brutal. Brutal. But yeah, anyhow.
We never had any real threats with thunderstorms.
Was Chuck Kroger Alfred Kroger?
Yes.
Okay. He ran the first year. So second year was probably when you got up there and asked for the chicken noodle soup
that
and the marriage proposal.
I think he retired after year one.
No.
And started running the aid station at Virginia's, because there wasn't anything up at Virginia's that I remember the first year. It was just what it was, you know, the pass. And it was, you were damn happy to get up there. And it was difficult because they didn't have ropes or anything like that then. You had to do all these little switchbacks in the snow, particularly on the Ouray side. On the Telluride side, it was easy because there was a trail more or less kicked in. But and not very steep. But as you know, the Ouray side is kind of steep. And it was too steep to glissade. And so you ended up having to kick step switchbacks up and down, which, you know, that's just the way it was. There was snow everywhere. There was snow everywhere. Oscar's Pass covered with snow.
I think with Oscar's Pass, I used my jacket and sat on it and sort of glissaded down various places because she could get there faster than trying to stay up on your feet.
That was coming over from Silverton at the pass between Silverton and the gulch down below Silverton. Sherman's Pass. That was Sherman's Pass.
Well, it all runs together, as you can tell.
But there was real snow. People kept getting stuck in the snow because you'd post hole because, heck, it was July at that point, and it should have been melting, but you'd post hole everywhere. Mm. It's brutal. Post hole everywhere. And it was really hard not to post hole. Cutting down into there was snow on all the passes. There's no other way to put it.
Rick and Nancy, thank you so much for spending time with us today to tell us about Hard Rock, to tell us about those early days, to tell us about your love of the San Juans. I miss seeing you out there in the summer, and I hope one of these summers you'll get back out to the San Juans and we can see you again on the streets of Uray or maybe over there by the rock in Silverton, inspiring all of those other hard rockers and hopeful hard rockers.
We do too. Nice seeing you guys.
Yes. Thanks so much for this. It was fun.
Keep having fun.
So I don't know if everybody saw the Instagram and Facebook announcements. The lottery will be open from October 12th until November 11th. So that's roughly a month to click a few buttons on Ultra Sign Up. If you don't get in by then, if you don't get your name into a lottery by then, you're out of luck. And probably justifiably so.
I think what we'll typically see is a huge spike the first day of everybody getting the excitement, and I encourage people to do that, because if you wait until the last day, then your anticipation and your excitement period is shortened, right? But if you put your name in on the first day, the drawing is still going to happen at the same time. But if you put your name in on the first day, you've got a longer period of anticipation and excitement. And so why not ride that wave for as long as you can? So Daniel, are you putting your name in the lottery for Hard Rock this year?
I am. Are you?
Yeah, I definitely am.
Well, I would hope so.
Yeah. We will probably both be volunteering again next year.
Heck yeah. Love it. I don't know if I'm ready to run it yet. I think I might need a couple more years of training.
Or
of mental hardening.
I think you're never ready to run Hard Rock until you run Hard Rock.
All right. November 11th closure date gives mm-hmm. Blake and the lottery gurus about a month to organize all the data, figure out how many tickets each person has, do data mm-hmm. corrections, as well as assemble all of the things necessary to do the lottery, which will happen live on Open Split Time on December 3rd. Also, we have decided to not do it on Twitter this time around. X, Twitter, whatever.
Yeah.
We are going to be deleting our Twitter, actually.
Wow. That's news. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's not a platform we're really using, mm-hmm. and I think we're better suited with Instagram, Facebook, a little bit of Threads usage. I think it will be much better usage to just do it live via Open Split Time. We may organize a way to put it up live on the Instagram channel, so that way you can see the Open Split Time feed, mm-hmm. But it will still just be that Open Split Time feed. There won't be commentary. Come on out. If you don't get your name pulled in the lottery, come on out. Mm-hmm. We'll be doing more shows about the lottery, specifically closer to the open dates and the closed dates. And we'll bring Blake on and talk about it, all the nuances associated with the lottery. Mm-hmm. A lot of people like hearing about the lottery. So I think it'll be a fun time to just sit down and talk
demystify it a little bit.
Because it's changed so much. People have become a little bit confused by it. So I think having somebody on who's so experienced with it mm-hmm. Would be awesome.
I agree. And there's no one more experienced with the lottery than Blake.
Yeah, everyone. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation with Nancy and Rick Hamilton. Please join us next time as we welcome former champion Chrissy Mayle onto the podcast. Thanks, everyone.
That's when I'll sing my mind.